want to get you thinking about foreign aid. Very tired subject, but one on which I find there's still a great deal of confusion. I don't mean to imply that I've got the final truth on the matter, but, well, I'm going to make some fairly dogmatic assertions. I will support most of them with evidence or reason, but I'm going to flip through this in a perhaps more dogmatic way than I ought to in order to allow time for you to shoot back or raise questions or present your favorite speech on foreign aid. I've called this the mythology of foreign aid because I set it up in the form of a number of myths and then what I call the logos to counter the myth, or the myth versus the reality. One of the reasons why I'm taking this topic up this morning, besides the fact that these were the notes that I could get at in my suitcase after I'd packed, was that this is something that gets Christians, some Christians at least, rather worked up. There are a number of Christians. Probably the outstanding example is Barbara Ward. If you know her, read any of her books, heard her talk, marvelous lady, a gifted orator, someone who can whip a crowd of 3,000 into fantastic enthusiasm for programs of heavy self-taxation to benefit the underdeveloped countries, and she does it all in the name of Christianity, love, and humanity. And there are many other people less effective than Barbara Ward who still preach this same gospel, that it is essential that Christians somehow bend themselves to the task of doing something about the plight of the poor nations of the world today. And inevitably, this gets us into the question of foreign aid. Well, what about foreign aid? Well, let me begin from the beginning. First myth is that the United States has given a lot of foreign aid. I wrote up there on the board, I don't know if you can see it, depends on how the light is shining on that board, the figures. That first column show from 46 to 52, which were the years in which we gave the most to foreigners. What that shows is net transfer payments to foreigners by the federal government. That's a pretty good measure of what we are in effect doing, foreign aid. Now, those were the years of the Marshall Plan. And in 1949, we went as high as $5.1 billion. But then it dropped as the Marshall Plan was completed. And from 1953 to the present, net transfer payments by our federal government to foreigners has varied between $1.8 billion and $2.3 billion. Never less than that, never more than that. Is that a lot? Over there on the right, I've given the net national product. Notice that in 1946, we were giving about 2%, a little better than 2%. Oh, wait a minute. No, that's wrong. 1%, excuse me. A little better than 1% of our net national product, which would be kind of our, our income. But look how poorly we're doing by 68. $2.0 billion out of a net national product of almost $800 billion. That isn't exactly breaking yourself. So we haven't been giving a whole lot away. You can check these figures with another set. The excess of United States merchandise exports over imports to developing countries. Now, developing countries are defined as all countries outside of the communist countries, Western Europe, Canada, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. And this figure, too, runs around $2 billion a year. In other words, goods, as distinct from services. Goods, things, flow out of this country to the developing countries every year, and some things flow back in. And we send to them about $2 billion in goods more than we take from them. Incidentally, this is a dangerous kind of a thing because much of this is in the form of loans. Much of this is going over there through private investment, and private investment expects to be repaid, which means these countries are, there's a distinct pot. Well, unless something happens within the next decade, these countries may have to, just in order to service these loans, send an excess of merchandise exports to the United States. And I don't believe that will happen, in part because our manufacturers aren't interested in anything being imported into this country, and they will, in their own interest, erect high tariff walls to keep them out. That may bail the foreign countries out of their difficulties. But anyway, we haven't given a whole lot away. Let me turn to the second myth, which is that our balance of payment situation won't allow us to extend any more foreign aid than we're now extending. Since gold has recently sort of disappeared from the headlines, you don't hear as much talk about the balance of payments, but people still bring this up. Well, the balance of payments is an accounting fiction. It's one of these things that accountants devise in order to keep track. And one of the nice things about the balance of payments is that it always balances. It's always in balance. You don't have to worry about the balance of payments being in balance. If you know anything about accounting, you know that assets always equal liabilities plus net worth, because net worth is the difference between assets and liabilities. And similarly, with the balance of payments, there are a whole bunch of little items that, you know, if they can't find that they changed, they say that they changed. And when they're all through, things still don't balance, they stick in something called statistical discrepancy. They add that on to whichever column is smaller. The point is that the balance of payments is a way of keeping track of foreign transactions. And for everything that goes out, there's got to be something that comes in, something to balance it. If the United States sends, as a pure gift, you know, if you grow yourself a rooster, slice off his head, deep freeze him, and send him to Aunt Minerva, that will be recorded in the balance of payments. That's going out. What comes back in? On the coming back inside, they've got a little balancing item, unilateral transfers. So it's kind of like out goes the gift of the rooster, and to balance it, sort of is the charity that stands on the other side. Now, well, then what's the problem? Well, the problem is this, that there are certain ways we don't want the balance of payments to balance. One way that we can balance it is by having gold flow out of the country. That makes us unhappy. I don't think it should. I think it'd be very nice if all the gold flowed out of the country myself, but we won't get into that. Maybe that would get us off the international gold standard. If we got off the international gold standard, we would stop doing so many idiotic things to stay on the gold standard. It seems the only reason for the best reason for staying on the gold standard is that if we don't stay on the gold standard, we'd be off the gold standard. But anyway, there are other things. We don't want gold to flow out of the country. We don't want to impose restrictions on imports. We don't want our foreign investors to do or to have to do sorts of certain kinds of things. We don't want to devalue the dollar. And if there's a sufficiently large list of things that you don't want to see done in your balance of payments account, then I suppose it becomes impossible for you to extend any more foreign aid. But this is a rather silly thing. This is letting the balance of payments determine national policy. And I think that's extremely short-sighted. Third myth is that foreign aid has been money down the drain. This isn't true. The Marshall Plan was foreign aid, and the Marshall Plan was a great success. Those years I have up there, 46 to 52, when we were sending, over $5 billion in 1 year, mostly to Western Europe, this worked. The aim of the Marshall Plan was the reconstruction of Western Europe, and it succeeded. So all foreign aid has not been billions, blunders, and baloney, as Eugene Castle would have it in his little book, Attacking Foreign Aid. That leads me to myth number four. The Marshall Plan's success proves that a big enough expenditure will create economic development. Unfortunately, Asia, Africa, and Latin America are not like Western Europe. Western Europe needed one input very specifically, capital. But most of the countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America need all kinds of things besides capital. They need knowledge primarily. They need systems of social organization. And these cannot be exported in any simple sense. Many of them even need stable governments. If a country cannot develop because it needs capital and has everything else, then a massive foreign aid program will do that country a lot of good. But there is almost no evidence to suggest, and a good deal of evidence to suggest that it is not so, that large infusions of American capital are going to do a great deal for the underdeveloped countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. I know this makes many people very, very happy. They say, goody gumdrops. Now we don't have to do anything for them because it wouldn't do any good anyway. I'm not saying it wouldn't do any good, and I don't think it's true that we don't have to do anything for them. But it is, I think, quite definitely not true that by simply, well, following Barbara Ward's suggestion, for example, take 1% of our net national product and give it to the underdeveloped countries. That might be a nice act of self-sacrifice. It might make us feel good. It might even stimulate the certain industries. But I don't think that it would do much to promote development in the underdeveloped countries. Okay. Myth number five, and this is one where I always step on toes. The United States has a moral obligation to make huge development grants to the underdeveloped countries. I think this is a myth because the United States has no moral obligations whatsoever. I realize that's sinful to say, but you see, my problem is I can't understand what it means for a nation to have a moral obligation. I know what you're talking about when you say, I have a moral obligation, an individual. When you talk about individuals having moral obligations, that makes sense to me. I've experienced a moral obligation, a sense of I must, I have no choice but to. But how can a nation have a moral obligation? I mean, where does it feel it? In Kansas? Nations, like all collectivities, are neither moral nor immoral. They are amoral. I just do not believe that moral categories apply to collectivities. And I apply this to the Vietnam War. There are a lot of clergymen running around and others saying, this is an immoral war. I just don't know what they're talking about. It's certainly not a moral war, but I don't see that it's an immoral war either. I happen to think it's a stupid war. And stupid is a, you know, that's a term that I can apply to the actions of the men who are conducting the war. I think we've made serious mistakes. But, I mean, who was immoral? You know, in the last days of the Johnson administration, in the last year or so, you heard people talking as if Johnson was the kind of ogre who really enjoyed burning babies to death. Some people talked as if Johnson was in there just, you know, for the sake of his ego. I don't believe this. And even if it were true, it would prove that Johnson was immoral, not that the nation is immoral. I think that we had better accept the fact, going to keep us out of a lot of trouble, that nations are amoral because they are. The national interest is the, it may be incorrectly perceived, but however perceived, it is the touchstone of foreign policy for the United States and for the countries with which we come into conflict. And I think we better believe it. He who relieth upon the moral sense of another country relieth upon a shaky crutch indeed and falleth on his face. It may not be in the Bible, but it's true anyway. You know, that this question, are nations morally bound to honor treaty obligations? Obviously not. Nations aren't morally bound. Now, of course, it makes sense to make people think you're morally bound, and if you can bamboozle somebody into thinking, I mean, if our State Department can bamboozle somebody into thinking that we are moral, that's very nice. That's to our benefit. Moreover, I think nations are not moral and do not accept moral obligations. They pretend to, but when the chips are down, they don't. Moreover, I don't think the nations should accept moral obligations. It seems to me that collectivities exist to serve the interests of the people who support those collectivities. A labor union should not be moral, but it should promote the interests of the members of the labor union. A corporation should not be moral, but it should promote the interests of the shareholders. And a government should not be moral, but it should promote the interests of the citizens. And whenever somebody, the President of the United States says, citizens, I know what your interests are, but I feel the call of a higher duty. I think it is time to replace him. Okay, myth number six. It is in the national interest of the United States to support economic development in the underdeveloped countries. You often hear it said that people don't go for communism unless they're hungry. Closer to the truth is that if people are sufficiently hungry, then they won't go for communism. I don't have a law here, but there is certainly an awful lot of historical evidence to support this, that the really poor, the really impoverished and underdeveloped countries don't go communist. It's the countries that have begun the process of development that go communist. Where is the strongest threat of, quote, communist takeover in Latin America today? Or where has, quote, communism taken over? If you check, you'll find it's in countries like Cuba and Venezuela, which are relatively developed. The really poor countries, like Haiti, they ain't going communist. The Dominican Republic under Trujillo, it wasn't going any place. You keep them really poor, and they just don't think about it. It's when development begins. It's almost as if development kind of gets the pot perking. I'm not saying, okay, let's keep them all, and keep all these countries broke so they don't go communist. I'll return to this later, suggest that we may not have any particular interest in not keeping them from, too many negatives in that. I'm going to suggest later that we maybe shouldn't be worried about whether they go communist or not. But in any event, developing countries seem to be more revolutionary than not developing countries. Moreover, we do not win friends by giving away aid. And some people say, well, I don't know, but at least they're all going to start developing someday, then they're going to get revolutionary. And when they start revolting, it would be good if we'd been in there 10 years earlier and we'd given something so they say, well, we're going to revolt, but we like the U.S. because they were nice to us. It doesn't work that way. I mean, do you love a benefactor? And who would you rather have come to stay with you right after Christmas? Aunt Minerva, who just sent you $100, or Aunt Tilda, who couldn't send you anything? Huh? Think about it. How do you feel when somebody who's just given you a lot of money or anything comes to stay? Kind of obligated, a little uneasy, got to be nice to her. She might be good for another 100 next year. And finally, as you think about it, you say, you know, darn it, we wouldn't have to take that $100 from Aunt Minerva. We would have had that $100 earlier if Aunt Minerva hadn't gypped us out of our inheritance. pretty soon you get, well.
Your hole is different.
At the same time, I'm not suggesting that the United States in the long run is going to be best off by just sitting back and letting every other country be poor. It seems to me that in the long run, a world characterized by extreme affluence, such as we have, and desperate poverty, such as most of the world has, is not stable. I cannot believe that in the long run that this world can continue to be the way it is now. So that somehow or the other, if we want to hang in there till the eschaton, we probably will have to see that something is done about the extremes of poverty and wealth in our world. Well, so that means that I'm maybe willing to allow room for foreign aid, since I'm suggesting that by the year 2000 or maybe sometime after that, if most of the world's people are still desperately poor, they're going to be so desperate that they'll blow the whole thing up. You know, as Marx says, when you have nothing to lose but your chains, well, you got nothing to lose. And, you know, pretty soon everybody will be able to build a little bomb in his backyard, and their missiles will get simplified too, and you'll have the means of delivery, and every little country that doesn't have enough to eat, so start playing blackmail games. This sort of thing could happen. And it would be nice to have a world in which everybody kind of lives in a glass house. You know, I mean, that's the basic reason why the Russians aren't so mean anymore, because they've got it made. You know, when the Russians were poor and didn't have much, then they were interested in revolution and shaking up the world. And very interesting how they feel peaceful coexistence is kind of nice. So they've made their sacrifices, and they want to sit down now and eat off the fat of the land. But, right, so I'm suggesting that maybe there is a national interest reason why the U.S. should answer generously the plea of the poor nations for aid. The trouble is that when we come down from the clouds into the real world, the world of concrete people and actual social institutions, we don't find poor nations asking for aid, but we find particular governments requesting aid. And this has a lot of implications. I'd just like you to think about one after the other. First implication is that when the United States acts favorably on a government's request for aid, it is buttressing that government. You say, so what? Well, most governments have opposition. When the United States government gives aid to a foreign government, it is supporting that particular government against whatever opposition exists in the country. And in most of these countries, the governments do have oppositions. I don't think that's a trivial point. How would we feel if, just prior to our election, Japan, let's say, made a generous gift to the Democratic Party? Democrats would feel it's fine. Republicans would be a little irritated. So that really brings us to the question that we continually come up against. Do we support all governments? Is a request by a poor government sufficient? And the answer, obviously, is no. We just support good governments. Now, that is the question, what's a good government? Is a good government one that supports our foreign policy? Or is it a government that's capitalistic? And if it's capitalistic, is it capitalistic in rhetoric or capitalistic in fact? We seem often to be much more interested in the rhetoric. I mean, if the government talks about free enterprise, you know, and cuts the heads off capitalists, that's all right, just so they don't talk socialistic. I don't know. Or is a good government one that's democratic and free? Or maybe free but not democratic? Or maybe democratic but not free? How democratic? How free? How pro-U.S.? Now, what makes a government good? And in trying to decide which governments are worthy of our support, the United States gets deeply involved in intervention in the domestic affairs of foreign nations. Moreover, many governments are corrupt. Even our governments have been known to practice an occasional corruption. Some government officials, would you believe it, prefer maintenance of their own power to the development of their country. Shocking. But you'll have to take my word for it. So what do we do? Well, what we do is we attach strings to our aid. We say, we will give you aid, but you cannot use it for corrupt and mendacious political purposes. You must use it to develop your country. Well, okay, so suppose there are two projects here. There are always more than two. That makes it more difficult. But what do we do? Both of these projects will have many consequences, many ramifications. Which one promotes long-run development? And which one just serves the short-term political interests of the government? For example, is a textile mill one thing that they might do with our aid? Is that a better thing to build because it gives the people clothing? Or is it a worse thing because it buys political popularity at the cost of establishing a necessary industrial base? Or how about a steel mill? Is a steel mill a good thing to build with our aid because it contributes toward long-run development? Or is it a worse thing because it's really a status symbol or a military asset? How do you decide? We get deeply involved in intervention when we try to make these decisions, including an assessment of all of the long-run implications and ramifications of the aid that we give. Furthermore, if we restrict all our grants, if we say, well, we can't trust you, you know, Uncle Sam knows best, we will give you aid in order to build a hydroelectric project that will irrigate the Ganges River, and that's all. So to make sure that you don't take that, you know, our aid and go off and do some bamboozle thing like, you know, build a four-lane highway between Punxsutawney and Putrid, and when there are no cars. You know, there are some of these. Nkrumah was great for that. He liked to build four-lane highways and occasionally eight-lane highways. And he figured the cars would come later.
Mao had one like that.
What?
Lawless has one too.
Do they?
Yeah. Does report it to me on it because I've been so mad at that kind of heat. About 50 miles there before we have it.
Well,
money for
what do you, all right, now the trouble is, when you, I like to use the example here of a university, because this is something you're all familiar with, but it applies, the analogy applies directly. You know, the federal government will give aid to church colleges, but not for religious purposes. It will give it for scientific purposes. So here's a church college. They had $1 million and they badly need a physics building. The government steps in and says, we will give you a physics building. They say, hot dog. They take their $1 million and they build a chapel. Now, did the government build the chapel or the physics building? On the government records, it built the physics building. But in fact, it built the chapel. You see, if the country was going to do something anyway, it was going to have to build its flour mill. But then the United States gave tied aid, restricted. Said, all you can do with this is build a flour mill. So they did. They were delighted. And they spent the funds that they had accumulated for the flour mill to build a four-lane highway. And now, how do you keep this from happening? Ask yourself, how could the government keep their aid from, in effect, supporting religious activities? And the answer is only by having several government officials in the administration of the university. There's no other way you can do it. Because you have to know the mind of the administrators. You have to know what they intended to do. And what your aid, how your aid changed their intentions. The lesson is that we can, if we really want to make sure that our aid goes for worthy purposes, we're going to have to get deeply involved in intervention in domestic affairs of other nations. Moreover, economic development is not the be-all and end-all that we pretend. Many countries are more interested in national power or national prestige than they are in economic development. There are many instances. And in the Arab nations today, they are making their situation worse. They are retarding their own development by their hostility toward Israel. I think this is fairly obvious. But if they had to choose, how many... I suspect the leaders here are the people, the ones who are really in a bind. I suspect that the leaders of the Arab countries would like to play down the Israeli thing and get about some of the more urgent tasks of the nation. But the people won't let them. It isn't always the leadership that is doing irresponsible things. I suspect that when the leadership is irresponsible, it is usually responding to the irresponsible goals and ambitions of the people. Sukarno in Indonesia, seemingly, prior to the coup d'etat, which threw him out, seemed to have enjoyed the support of the majority of the people. In his wild projects, Sukarno threw the economic development of Indonesia down the drain for the sake of interfering with the formation of the Malaysian Federation, throwing the Dutch out of West Irian, and otherwise meddling. And then the important thing was not whether the people had enough food. In one speech, this is what he said. He told the people of Indonesia, you'll have to tighten your belts. Food is not the end of life, but the glory of the nation. And they cheered. We step into a country and we say, look, we'll give you some aid if you get down to business and start about the task of economic development and don't go mussing. They'll take the aid if they can get it, but they will intend to muss. And if they really have to make the choice, they will often tell us to get lost with our aid. Because by golly, they're going to must. I mean, I wonder how much aid we would have to give the Arab nations to persuade them to say to Israel, we like Jews. How about private foreign investment? I've been talking now about government intervention. And that raises a question. Well, maybe to prevent all this government intervention, because we don't want the U.S. to get deeply involved in the domestic affairs of another nation, maybe private Americans can take over the task of extending aid. And this has much to be said for it, I think. It minimizes intervention. And when private American capital goes abroad, it tends to take along technical skills. It's very important. And I would say that private American investment abroad has done a great deal in small areas, and things only happen in small areas, but they happen, when they happen in one small area after another. The trouble is that foreign and private foreign investment presupposes security for that investment. And this leads inevitably to the demand for government pressure, U.S. government pressure on foreign governments. Foreign investment went ahead very rapidly in the days of gunboat diplomacy, but those days are over. I mean, it used to be, you know, the British would invest somewhere, and if the natives got a little restless and threatened to break the windows on the factory, we'd send in a gunboat or two, we'd park it in the harbor, we'd shoot a couple of natives, and things calmed down, and that made a nice environment for investors. British citizens would invest quite confidently around the world. But we don't do that anymore today. It's considered bad form to send your gunboats into a harbor and shell somebody just because they want to break the windows of your factory. We cannot expect... Well, look where most American private foreign investment goes today. It goes to Western Europe, and Japan, and Canada. And some of it now goes to Latin America, but, the flag follows it closely. The United States is deeply involved in intervention in Latin America. We don't call it intervention. It's cooperative programs. It's alliances for progress and all of that. One of the reasons that the Alliance for Progress just couldn't get going is because this basic question could never be settled. To what extent does the United States reserve the right, if it's putting up the loot, to keep its hand on the controls? We ain't going to give you guys all kinds of money if you're going to turn right around and confiscate, nationalize the property of AT&T. Moreover, capitalist investment abroad obviously presupposes a capitalist environment. And I have come increasingly to the opinion that economic development in most of the countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America is going to require social revolution. Now, a capitalist environment just is not a revolutionary environment. It's revolutionary in a sense. I mean, capitalism does revolutionize, as Marx said. It revolutionizes the whole structure of society. But it takes for granted a relatively structured, stable bourgeois society to begin with. It is true that capitalism, both on its own and because of the way in which it calls its government in behind it and says, sick 'em if anything gets too revolutionary, has a tendency to dampen down revolutionary ferment. And if it is true that social, political, economic revolution is going to have to occur in these countries before they can really begin developing, then it is quite possible that American investment will slow down economic development. It will kind of put off the necessary surgery. That our investment is a series of aspirin tablets which keep the patient just contented enough that he doesn't realize he's got a tumor that has to be removed. We are, as I said, Latin America is the best example. We are continually in the business of trying to support non-revolutionary, sort of status quo supporting political movements. Is it in the national interest to engage in this kind of intervention? The trouble is it gets us too deeply involved in too many things that we can't keep track of. And the nation that tries to run the world, intervening everywhere, winds up with a couple of million troops in South Vietnam. It doesn't know quite how it got them in there. Is that in the national interest? Well, let me wind up with some quick observations. It is not in the national interest. Now, you can quarrel about all of these things. I'll let you quarrel in 3 minutes, 4 minutes. It is not in the national interest of the United States that we become deeply enmeshed in the internal political or economic affairs of other nations. And it is not in the national interest that we pour money down rat holes. I take those as axioms. It probably is in the national interest that the United States avoid the odium and the risk incurred by the meddlesome benefactor. It probably is in the national interest that we promote political stability in our world. It probably is in our national interest to promote, when it doesn't get us very deeply involved, responsible, rational governments. Thus, it probably is in our interest to provide some kind of aid that satisfies more urgent popular expectations, but without arousing extravagant expectations. And it probably is in our interest, this kind of follows from the last thing I said, to alleviate the extremes of human suffering due to poverty in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. This leaves scope for programs of foreign aid. But it would seem to require, above all, some shifts in popular attitude. And I think this is the most important thing that we can do right now during this kind of interregnum. Because we're not launching any new foreign aid programs. We're all messed up and we're trying to get our wits collected and figure out just what is the relationship of the United States to the rest of the world. And during this time, I think it's essential that the American public engage in a serious discussion of what kind of basic attitudes we as citizens want to have toward the world. And here are some shifts that I think ought to occur. We ought to say freely and frankly that the socialism or capitalism of a country is of little, if any, interest to us. If a country wants to go socialist, bless its cotton picking hide. May it prosper, and if it does not, we don't care. What do we care whether a country is capitalistic? You know, we sometimes act like little children. Say we're capitalistic and we want everybody else to be capitalistic too, so that when the final reckoning is made, we got more points than anybody else. We treat this as some kind of big volleyball game. Another thing we're going to have to recognize is that Asia, Africa, and Latin America are not much interested in Jeffersonian democracy. And the philosophy of John Locke is largely irrelevant to their situation. So to talk about promoting free and democratic governments around the world is nonsense. I think it's just the sheerest kind of nonsense. I believe in freedom and I believe in democracy, but I believe in American-style freedom and American-style democracy because I know what that means. I don't know what freedom and democracy could possibly mean in South Vietnam. And so when people get into an argument about whether the South Vietnamese government is free and democratic, I think they're talking about it. It's just a nonsensical question. A third observation is that government-to-government aid seems to me less desirable today than private aid, and we ought to recognize that. Now, that doesn't mean that we should abandon foreign aid, but I think that we ought to start, if we're really concerned. I mean, if you as individuals are concerned, if large groups of Americans are concerned about doing something to alleviate the poverty of the world, I think we ought to ask ourselves, what can we as private citizens do without invoking the government? And one of the things that I hope will evolve in the coming years, I see some signs of its evolution, is that Americans organized, perhaps through affiliated bodies of their churches, through special foundations or corporations that are established to do this, through foundations established by large corporations. There are many possible ways that Americans will be willing to give their time and their resources for programs that support the activities chosen by domestic governments. I think it's terribly important that if Americans give aid, they give aid on the terms on which it is asked for by the country to which the aid is going. A long sentence again. Let's stop telling them what's good for them. If we want to help, let's help them on their terms. Let's give them what they ask for, even if we don't think it's wise. And this is about the only kind of foreign aid program that I think has much chance to succeed and will also keep us out of trouble. Of course, it's very, very difficult for governments to do that. It's one of the reasons why I think it's going to have to be privately extended. And then last thing is that trade is better than aid. One of the advantages of trade is that it involves mutual advantage. And you see, it doesn't get you all hung up in this question of, well, we're doing goody for you, what do you owe us? When countries trade, they're both benefiting, and so they're on equal terms. And there's far more scope for this than we realize. So massive infusions of aid, as I said before, are not a cure-all. Let's remember that they're even capable of anesthetizing the patient, leading to death, and we must be very, very careful in particular about massive infusions of food. I know people are hungry and they're starving and all of that, and we should give them food, but we have to do this very, very adroitly. some gifts of food by the United States set back the agricultural development of the countries to which the aid is given. And this is not something we want to do. We want to promote agricultural development in these countries. I would just wind up then with a statement that the development of Asia, Africa, Latin America is something that in the long run is going to have to occur if we want a stable world. But if they are to develop towards self-sustaining growth, they're going to have to go through revolutions, and this is going to make us uneasy, but let's keep our cool. Let's be able to observe social, cultural, technological, economic, political revolutions without supposing that every revolution that occurs anywhere in the world in the long run is going to start a series of dominoes tottering down. Let's let the foreign policy of the United States government not be directed to stopping these revolutions or even guiding these revolutions, but just making marginal adjustments to be sure that the vital interests of the United States are not seriously affected by these revolutions. And that's plenty for the State Department to do. But I say the State Department is operating under a great deal of pressure from private citizens. And I think that there's probably more wisdom in Foggy Bottom than there is in Minnesota, even Minnesota. I suspect that one of the reasons that the United States gets so deeply involved in this kind of ideological adventuring is because the people want it. We do see ourselves as kind of world messiah with responsibilities across the globe to make sure everybody is capitalistic, free, democratic. We get very upset by all kinds of revolutions. You know, maybe take one example, Rhodesia, Northern Rhodesia. You know, this is kind of the other side of the fence. The Americans, we had to do something. That's a racist government. What are we going to do? We got to get in there. We got to stop that. Impose sanctions. Shall we send troops? I say keep our cool. I don't like the Northern Rhodesia, the government of Northern Rhodesia. But you know, there are lots of other governments in this world I don't like either. And if we run around trying to create justice in every hamlet, we are going to wind up with troops in every hamlet. And let us not. Let's be humble. Okay, boy, long-winded. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the point of private investment for aiding the countries where they believe it will do them the most good. Won't this require quite a change in investment attitude in the United States, where before we required a stable environment for capitalistic and profitable investment, now we would just literally be giving them whatever they want for their own good as a really very basically unselfish motive?
Well, perhaps, but not necessarily. I think there could be both kinds of things. I think private corporations might be induced by these governments to do the things that those governments want done. And this sometimes occurs. The Kaiser Corporation, for example, has done this. It has come in at the invitation of the government and taken its orders from the government. That the projects in which some American corporations have been involved abroad have been projects bought up and then promoted by the locals. But I think there is scope for this, but I think there's also scope for charitable activities. I'm hoping, I don't know exactly what form this might take, but I think I can detect signs of a seed germinating here, that private charitable foundations will be established, which will try to pull together resources that will be available on a charity basis to governments that ask for them. Much of this can be education. There's a lot that can be done by Americans, and many American college students today are extremely idealistic and would enjoy this kind of thing. The Peace Corps sort of proves this. One of the reasons that the Peace Corps is declining in appeal, I think, is because the notion is growing that the Peace Corps is kind of an arm of the American government. It's kind of an imperialistic arm. We're really over there not for the benefit of those countries, but in order to make them like America. Well, if Americans and Europeans were willing to go over and take orders from the local school boards, were willing to do what those countries say needs to be done, I think that it would be of greatest benefit to those countries. And certainly, this would be charitable in large part.
Well, how about working for international organizations? Wouldn't that be possible?
Oh, boy.
International what?
What about working through international organizations? Trouble is, that sounds very good, but international organizations today are not really free from political consideration. That's the problem. It would be good if we really had some international organizations who were international in their focus. Now, you've got some idealists up there somewhere who probably are, who consider themselves citizens of the world, who really feel their first loyalty is to the community of nations.
Money still comes out of particular
nations. Yeah. But if they act like that too much, they wind up idealists with no resources.
Yeah.
But Paul, there are some, you know, and this is what hurt the Scandinavians, because they got their own Peace Corps now. But when we started this, I got a big correspondence with Humphrey on this, and his whole point was fine, but I can never get it through Congress. I'll be glad if we can get the Peace Corps through, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came out, just think of the crazy, silly arguments they had on it, you know. I mean, this whole southern that's in control of so much of every aspect of our legislative activity, I can't see how they would possibly stand by and hand some money to a country and say, well, now use it for what you think is best, you know.
Yeah.
It just isn't going to happen this side of heaven, I don't think. I mean, they just can't see this in our national interest. I wish they could.
Well, Carol, why? They would see it as in the national interest if this kind of activity aroused the enthusiasm of a sufficiently large number of Americans. I mean, one of the reasons why our government can, without any fear of popular reprisal at all, give boatloads of aid when an earthquake occurs is because it makes Americans feel good. Now, I would hope that Americans become sufficiently world-oriented that they just feel good about projects of this sort. I don't ever expect the United States government, within the foreseeable future, I don't think that the United States government is going to be embarking on vast programs of foreign aid that really arouse this kind of enthusiasm and sympathy in the public. But I think there would obviously be a lot more scope for it if Americans would become more world-oriented. If, for example, we would say, look, we have whipped the problem of poverty in this country, at least we have the means, the technical means, why don't we do something about the problem of distribution? Why don't we do something about the meaninglessness of suburban life by admitting that maybe suburban life isn't the answer and experimenting with some other kinds of answers. Right now, we're so hung up on improving the standard of living. I mean, we middle class people are so hung up on improving our own standards of living that we're not willing to experiment with anything. And I think this is just a failure of perspective. I don't know how you change that perspective. Preaching won't do it. Perhaps the growing sense of the meaninglessness of the squirrel cage in which we're running around, maybe that will do it. Maybe another possibility is that the danger will do it, that domestically, just the risk that the people who don't have may blow the whole thing up so that we who have won't have any more either. Maybe that will prompt us to lift up our eyes to the hills and see what other things might be done than building backyard barbecues. And with respect to the world, maybe as we notice wars and rumors of wars around the world, maybe we will somehow be freed from our obsession with our own private, immediate, domestic interests. But until Americans adopt a more global orientation, I can't see that the United States government is going to be able to spend. Politically, it's just not going to be able to appropriate a lot of money to foreign aid. Yeah.
I've also heard, my ear of a group, I can't remember the name, they started working in Mexico where they were going to an area and get to know the people and find out what they needed or what things they needed to become to start an economic growth. And then we'd be able to induce manufacturers in America to bring equipment in, whether it was bulldozers or so forth. And eventually, you know, it was sort of a loan, but these people would actually buy the equipment on a long-term basis, and it would become theirs. Plus, this organization also provided the technology and so forth. So, to where the people were actually helping themselves, mm-hmm. and they became self-sufficient. And then, when this was eventually set up, then this organization would leave. And now they're spreading out into Latin America and South America. And I've heard of, I'm not sure though, I've heard of other companies, large corporations in America that are working now, especially in our own country, but and I'm not sure about outside of it, where they actually are giving away their own profits in certain things, like in New York City, setting up street academies or in education, where they provide the funds for kids off the streets to get an education where they otherwise couldn't in public schools. And this idea of just plowing money in without expecting any return,
I don't think people will ever plow money in without expecting a return, but I think we can at least hope that people will plow money in without knowing what form the return will take. Having the courage to respond to the explicit request of the poor, and this applies domestically or internationally, to give the poor what they are asking for or demanding, and hoping that something good will emerge from this, without knowing what form it might take.
It seems like it's much more difficult, and Niebuhr is very good at this point, where he talks about individual versus corporate organization, where an individual can do this much easier than a corporation or an organization or a bigger group. He can feel free to give in this manner, where it's much more difficult for a corporation.
Yeah. Unless we form corporations, unless people who have this kind of freedom form their own corporations.
Well, and even in the distribution aspect of what our government does, I think we could do more, I mean, from the church's point of view, because the group that dominates how this food is distributed or where this money is put, I mean, we're on the other end, the distribution side, are almost all of the Mormons. From the simple fact that the Mormons have got this program of two guys, you know, that go out to these different places and give 2 years of their life, and they're around there picking up jobs after with the state, you know, or agriculture department or so on. And from our friends in the government, from our own particular church, they say this is just appalling. It's almost dominated by Mormon mentality wherever we go, and it does just kind of hang up with legalism, you know. And we get this problem of how we create a humane sort of a situation here. I think a lot has to do with even like the young adult world we represent here, to get some of them interested in making their life work in this area of our foreign aid, so-called, you know. And some of it is through our churches. What our foreign missions department haven't done here, when the Mennonites have been around giving us an example for 25 glorious years of what you can do here, you know, where you send out breeding cattle and you send a guy with them to show them how and live with them for a bit, and they know how to use them, you leave the cattle behind and he comes home, you know. And this has been a tremendous thing. And we keep on trying to force them to take our missionaries whether they like it or not, using all the, you know, pressures of the State Department and our people who are there to get a visa and get them in, instead of the fact that they're eager to have this kind of a thing happen. I think this is part of what comes here. Within these free groups within our society that you talked about that has to take it over, we haven't put the pressures we need.